The connection to the ambulance was lost right after that loud noise.
Hi, Zainab.
In him?
They had to ask her, did you hear a bomb now? Did you hear anything around you? And she said, yes, yes, I heard it. Her yes means our colleagues who went to rescue her had died.
The night won't end. That's an excerpt of Sharif before we go to break. And so what happened to everyone?
Well, they kept talking to Hind on the phone. That call lasted almost 3 hours. And at some point, night comes on. Hind's voice gets fainter and fainter. We have to remember she's injured, she's bleeding, and then her voice disappears. And it's basically 12 days before the Israeli forces withdraw. Civil defense workers can enter that area. They confirm that Hind has been killed along with her entire family, and the two ambulance workers have been killed with a direct hit on the ambulance.
Even though Israel had given the permission for them to go in.
They gave them permission with a map with an approved route.
Sharif Abdelkaddous, correspondent, and the new Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, and Kavitha Shakuru, the film's director. Back with them in 20 seconds.
Yeah. The people, they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You can pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means. AIPAC, Koofi, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You can ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm. But it's too late. We've seen the truth. We bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children.
Hind's
and
those Hall that you murdered by Macklemore. Hind's Hall, the name that encampment activists gave to Hamilton Hall at Columbia University when they took it over. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we continue with this new horrifying documentary called The Night Won't End. That's premiering on Al Jazeera today, just after we broadcast this show at aljazeera.com. It will be made available. Kavitha, you profile three families. Tell us about the Salams.
So the Salam family, they're a family in North Gaza, and they, after being displaced from their home early in the war, they were sheltering with relatives. And on December 11th, a massive airstrike hit the building. Over 100 people were killed, mostly from their extended family. So after that the building was destroyed, they tried to find shelter elsewhere. A week later, in the building they had gone to, in the days leading up to that, Israeli ground troops, who at this point had a pretty substantial presence in the north, they had kind of laid siege to the building. According to the civilians we spoke to, no one fought back, so the soldiers would have known that it was only civilians there. On December 19th, in the afternoon, Israeli soldiers entered the building. They separated the men and women. They stripped the men, and then they summarily executed at least 11 of the men in that building.
Sharif, set up this next clip.
Well, as Kavitha describes, and let me just say, but the Salem family is featured in an AP investigation that was just reported a few days ago. That was looking at 60 Palestinian families that lost at least 25 members each. And this is the wiping out of entire bloodlines of families across generations. And this is part of the genocide case that's been brought against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And the Salem family is a part of that. But this family, after being bombed, losing 100 people of their family, then moves to try and seek shelter, as Kavitha explained. On December 19th, Israeli troops are around the area. They've been shelling this building. No one's fighting back. They enter the building, and they storm the apartment. They separate the men and the women. They beat them. They abuse them. And then we hear the witnesses describe what happens next.
The women had been separated from the men, but Hiba says they could see them from where they were.
They tortured them while we were watching them. They broke my husband's jaw. They broke this part of his face. He began bleeding. They tortured him by beating his arms with their rifles until they bled. And the same with my son. They beat him all over his body. Then they stripped them of their clothes, just kept them in their boxers, and made them all lay down on the ground like this.
The survivors say the Israeli soldiers then executed the men in front of them.
They started to carry out executions in front of our eyes. They didn't spare anyone. They created a bloodbath. I swear to God, it's a day that cannot be forgotten. It won't be forgotten.
At least 11 men were killed, including Hiba's husband, Ayman. Yahya and Aday were both injured and passed out, but they survived.
There was someone next to me who tried to get up, so they fired a crazy number of bullets at him. This is on top of the torture they subjected us to. I passed out from the torture.
I was hit here with two bullets. I lost consciousness. Between one moment and the next, I was near death. No matter what I say, I won't be able to express what I felt and lived through. This was one of the worst days of my life.
Yahya then keels over as he describes what happened. He and another man were the only two survivors of the men. Kavitha, how did you corroborate the story? For our radio audience, we are showing blood on the walls, but how did you tell the story?
Yeah, so we began with the survivors. So we have the testimony of six survivors from that attack. Then there's a number of other pieces that we were able to kind of put together, one of which is satellite imagery from December 19th, which around 8:30 a.m. shows tanks one block away from the building. So we know that so there's that. And then there's the testimony. And then once the soldiers left the building, one of the survivors, she started sending WhatsApp messages on a group chat, and it went to a number of their relatives who were outside of Gaza. So we were able to get those messages and spoke to the woman who sent them, as well as two of the people who received it, and verify the time. And then the next day, once the soldiers left the building and left that vicinity, other people went into the building and they took a video, which we were able to verify. And in the video, you see, not only do you see the bodies of the men, you see, we didn't show this because it was too graphic, was the body of the Salem's young, their daughter, Nada. And then at the very end of it, you see Yahya alive, barely alive. And then there was another video of that as well. So there's two videos. And then in addition to that, Al Jazeera, the news crew in the area, filmed the survivors when they went to the hospital. So it was kind of basically a chronological piecing together of everything that happened.
So I want to get to accountability. You were not granted an interview with the White House or State Department, so you sought out the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, as he was testifying at a congressional appropriations hearing. Now, Sharif, you are coming up to him, approaching him with this question.
Secretary Blinken, a question from Al Jazeera. What is your message to the families of Palestinian civilians who were killed with U.S. weapons in Gaza? Why is your administration not enforcing U.S. and international law to hold Israel accountable?
So, Sharif, you are chasing Secretary of State Antony Blinken, but did not succeed in getting an answer from him.
Let me just say, Amy, that we tried for months, literally, to ask for an interview with the White House, anyone at the White House, or the State Department.
Kavitha, you've been trying since January?
January was the first email I sent to the State Department.
And we were granted no access, no interviews whatsoever, so we resorted to trying to track down officials. We went to several White House press briefings. I wasn't called on. Went to State Department press briefings, wasn't called on. So we had this chance with Secretary Blinken. He didn't answer the question. But this just goes to the point of the Biden administration has unequivocally supported Israel in its war on Gaza. Time and time again, they have bypassed Congress twice at least to continue arming Israel. And there's no question that U.S. weapons have killed civilians in Gaza. And so this violates both international humanitarian law and domestic law. And we hear the Secretary General of Amnesty International saying she will never forget U.S. complicity in this conflict.
Well, also, Sharif, I mean, one of the people that you interview in the documentary is Akbar Shahid Hamid, who tells you explicitly that he's spoken to Israeli officials who say that the U.S. could stop the war now because Israel could not prosecute the war without the U.S.
Well, I think that's very clear. The United States is Israel's top arms supplier. It's its top backer economically and diplomatically. We saw them veto multiple Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire at the UN. Israel could not prosecute this war without the continued arming billions of dollars worth of arms to Israel. And I think that's very clear. And just before we end, I just want to say that we dedicated the film to the journalists of Gaza, and particularly to our Al Jazeera colleagues who were killed, including Samer Abu Da'a, who was killed in an Israeli strike on a school in Khan Yunis on December 15th that also injured Al Jazeera's bureau chief, Wael Dahdouh. And then his eldest son was killed in a drone strike along with Mustafa Thuraya, another journalist working with Al Jazeera, on their car just northeast of Rafah on January 7th. And they're just three of the journalists amongst as many as 150 journalists who have been killed, a record number. This film is dedicated to them.
People can watch this film that is being released today at aljazeera.com and also, Kavi, as well on Al Jazeera's YouTube channel?
Yeah, correct.
And remember, when you watch coverage in the corporate media of what's happening in Gaza, count how many times that network tells you, whatever the network, whether we're talking Fox, MSNBC, CNN, how many times do they tell you their reporters are not allowed in Gaza, unaccompanied? This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our guests have been Sharif Abdelkaddous, correspondent on the new Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, and Kavitha Chukwuru, the film's director. Back in a minute.
To look at me that way, don't take it again. But if you do, give me part of your day. It's the weathering you brought me, it leaves a shadow on my finger. Hit a skinhead with it last winter, and you would be proud of me. I'm not on my knees anymore. I can really feel the flow. Let's go up north, or you have no will to. You wanna find the people who want to kill you. There's a place in your heart that I can't get into. And God is calling. It's been years since you've been back. You can't keep what's in your hands. And God is calling. Every time I say your name, there's a wall that's in the way. And we grew up on a street where everyone
take the day. You wear that scarf like it's a fade. Always pack your mother's plates. You won't let
Gaza is calling escape. By Mustafa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with a new dramatic film titled Green Border about the humanitarian crisis facing millions of migrants seeking refuge in Europe. It tells the story of how refugees from the Middle East and Africa have been trapped at the so-called green border between Poland, which is part of the European Union, and Belarus, a Russian ally. The feature film is directed by highly acclaimed, award-winning Polish director and screenwriter Agnieszka Holland. In a career spanning 50 years, she's directed more than 20 films and several television productions in countries and in languages across Europe, as well as in the US and Canada. Green Border received high praise and recognition, including the Special Jury Prize at the 2023 Venice Film Festival, but was strongly condemned by the then far-right government in Poland. Green Border premieres today at New York at Film Forum and nationwide next Friday. This is the film's trailer. For our radio audience, we voiced over the Polish, Arabic, and French into English.
From Belarus, we go to Poland, and then to your uncle in Sweden. Remember, everything is paid for, and he'll take you to the best border crossing.
What is that?
Get out. Let's go. Run.
This isn't propaganda. It's a real threat. They aren't people. They are live bullets.
They need to get themselves together, somewhere safe.
You mean migrants?
Refugees.
If you want to work with us, you have to accept the rules. We give food, water, medicines, and we don't enter to the exclusion zone, okay?
Look, I didn't see anything, neither did you.
What are you talking about?
We shouldn't worry about issues beyond our control.
They're keeping an eye on you.
I know.
They'll track us.
What is really going on?
What do you think we're doing out there?
What kind of father would take his child down this road?
Helping is not illegal.
Everything is going to be all right.
That's the trailer for the new film Green Border that is premiering tonight in New York City. For more, we're joined by Green Border's acclaimed director, Agnieszka Holland. Her work has received a number of accolades, including being nominated for an Academy Award 3 times. Like Green Border, several of her previous films have centered around events that constitute crimes against humanity. Mr. Jones portrays the man-made 1930s Ukrainian famine. Europa, Europa, and In Darkness are based on true stories during the Holocaust. Her HBO miniseries, Burning Bush, focuses on the self-immolation of a 20-year-old protester following the Prague Spring. Holland was herself arrested and briefly imprisoned in Prague for her involvement in the protests at the time. Agnieszka Holland, it is our honor to have you in our studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Tell us about Green Border. Tell us about this remarkable film that deals with such a major crisis in the world today, how the world treats its refugees. In fact, refugees themselves play some of your actor, play the people in the film.
Yeah, you know, I'm following the refugees crisis since 2015 in Europe. Of course, it's older than that. But that crisis, as a consequence of the Syrian domestic war, triggered the big change in European mentality and in European politics. It became clear that the fear and the hate are so easy to be spread when our borders or our comfort is attacked by the challenge of newcomers. And Europe is built by the migration somehow, but in the same time, Europe is powerless when efficiently dealing with the challenge of people of different culture, different language, different race, and so on. So 2015 and that first big wave of the refugees triggered the race of the populism and extreme right in the in European politics, and it became quite clear that Europe became some kind of the hostage of exterior regimes who started to use to manipulate the corridors and numbers of refugees coming to Europe for political means. It means to destabilize Europe. On another hand, the response of the European Union politicians have been very inadequate. It means they started to play the game practically. Not only play the game and initiate the hate and fear, but also to take advantage of that game, to build their own political agenda and electoral agenda on the treatment and the presentation of the refugee problem. So we became all hostages of incapacity to face the truth and to be just human and to accept and respect the laws which are the ground of the democracy, the human rights, equality, solidarity, constitutions of the countries and international treaties. So, frankly, it is an incredible mess right now. And it's going in a very dangerous direction because I was doing, as you mentioned, few films about the crimes against humanity in '30s, '40s of 20th century. I know and understand pretty well the mechanism, how it starts, how the dehumanization of the group of the people leads to dehumanization altogether of entire nations or races. And how easy this avalanche starts to grow, and how easy it is to change the public opinion on that subject, and how visible is serpent's egg which is growing.
And you've said, in fact, that the situation of these migrants is perhaps, quote, and I'm quoting you here, a prequel to a drama that could lead to the moral and also political collapse of our world. So if you could talk about the urgency you felt in making this film and the difference of making a film where you see a crime against humanity literally unfolding before you as against making one about the Ukrainian famine or the Holocaust several decades ago.
Yeah, it is different urgency when I'm speaking about the past and about something which happened already, even if I did that film because I felt that they are relevant. It means that that somehow, you know, that the danger didn't disappear. It was put to sleep by terrible experience of Second World War. And somehow we've been immune against that for a while. But that immunity, that vaccine, started to evaporate quite a long time ago. I felt it already in the 90s, but it became very visible to me after September 11, that it was the moment when I think the world shifted to another side somehow. So, and when it came to my border, it means 100 miles or 200 miles from the place I live in Poland, and I was born, when it was my government, even if I didn't vote for them, but the government representing my country, which is dehumanizing people and responding to that crisis by propaganda and lie and violence, I had to speak about it, so that it was immediate. I decided like 1 month after the crisis started, and when the access to the zone around of the border have been blocked for the journalists, media, humanitarian organizations and medical organizations, it means it was impossible to show in documentary way what's going on. I decided to make the fiction and to use my skills to show to the world what's going on, and also to give back the faces and voices to those who became voiceless and faceless and became just the tool of Lukashenko and Putin on one side and European propaganda on another side.
And so if you could talk about the stories that you did tell. I mean, the film is not a documentary, but it is based on accounts that you heard in your extensive research into the film from refugees. So the film is told from it's three different parts: the refugees, the border guards, and finally the activists. And you spoke to people who occupy all of those positions right. in real life as part of your research. So if you could talk about this, and also the point that you've made about how making a film, a fiction film, allows you to treat the subject reality synthetically rather than just describing it. So if you could talk about these three things, the three different sections, the perspectives that you represent, and what fiction can allow you to do.
Of course, the most important is the voice of the refugees, because they've been deprived of that voice. They've been just totally silenced, or not only silenced, but presented as a terrorist, pedophiles, zoophiles, and so by official propaganda by the government, Polish government then. Somehow, you know, all actors of that crisis are the victims and are facing very difficult and sometimes impossible choices. So we decided with my co-screenwriters to take that epical point of view and exactly to make it as a multi-voice story. Which seemed logical to me also because it was the first film about that particular crisis and maybe the last one I was thinking and when we've been trying to make it. I talked to the activists, that it was easy because a lot of them are my friends from before. I was talking to the local people who suddenly became activists even if they didn't plan it at all. And some became the witnesses, confused witnesses of the situation, which reminds them so much Second World War. And to the refugees, to several refugees in person, to many of them just watching the recording, which was made by the activists and are anonymous somehow, because not everybody wants to speak about their situation. They are in legal limbo, even if they pass to Europe. By the end, I was able to talk to some border guards, which was the most difficult, of course, because it's a military force. And they are, some of them feel guilty, but many of them feel in right to do what they are doing. So it is not black and white situation, all of that. And, you know, I was also asking myself how big role the racism is playing in that kind of the, you know, of the reception of that crisis by the Polish population.
And you clearly show it by comparing it to the incredibly humane approach of the Polish government to receiving the millions of Ukrainians after Russia invaded Ukraine as people were fleeing for their safety. You compare that to what Poland has done on the border with Belarus to the refugees.
Yeah, that is very instructive, that double standards. But we have to say that we cannot simplify it. It's not only racist which plays the role here. It is also the closeness to the Ukraine, the fact that it happens just behind our border, that in Poland lives big Ukrainian diaspora, the workers, the fact that we have common enemy, because Putin is also our Polish enemy. And
we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two of this interview and post it online. Agnieszka Holland has been our guest. Her new film, Green Border, premieres tonight in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
Hey,
Are you a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit student? Not convinced university, college, or vocational trade school is possible? Or wondering what you should do after high school? Inspire can help you and your friends. Register for Inspire's free Indigenous mentorship program, Rivers to Success. Joining Rivers to Success gets you access to great information, great prizes, and exciting content. Discover careers and post-secondary paths geared towards Indigenous students across Turtle Island, just like you. Register online today at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.